Superintendent State Affairs to order. It's about 2 minutes after nine. In attendance, we have the co-chair or vice chair, Senator Geisel, Senator Coghill, and Senator Wilkowski. It is a delight, Senator Wilkowski, to have you on my right. Supporting the committee, we have doing the recording of the minutes and actions. It's Nancy Jones, and behind me is Sam Greeley, who is handling the communications and the sound and all that sort of thing. Encourage you all to turn off your cell phones, and these mics are very sensitive, so be a little careful about swearing quietly and anything you say, and also ruffling papers and so on, and move the mics close to you when you speak, and that'll make it a little easier for our folks to hear, to be recorded, and I suspect people who may want to monitor the conversations. Today, we are talking about one of the seminal issues that is facing our state, and that is the control of Alaska's lands. During the statehood debate, one of the arguments in Congress was, how will this remote group of people in state ever be able to support themselves? And they wisely knew that this would be, our most of our income would come from resources, and we have seen in those 50 plus years that our economy is a resource driven economy, and there are huge battles going on. And we have invited two men who are very deeply involved in these battles, and the first is our Attorney General, Michael Garrity. He's the state's chief law enforcement officer, and the state's involvement in both civil and criminal attitudes. He has 550 attorneys and staff in the Department of Law, 13 offices. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Garrity, and also is Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Dan Sullivan. He has 1,100 people working for the Department of Natural Resources around the state, and they're responsible for managing a large portfolio of oil, gas, renewable energy, minerals, timber, land, and water, and as well as overseeing the regulatory activity on approximately 160 million acres of land. Would you gentlemen like to introduce your staff that are here?
Yes, for the Department of Law, I've got my deputy in charge of the civil affairs, Jim Cantor, and Corey Mills, our legislative liaison, and then Kent Sullivan is one of the assistant attorney generals who will be testifying, I think, before this committee later this week on related issues.
And I believe that's it from law.
Thank you.
Commissioner Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have with me Ed Fogles, the deputy commissioner, Esther Temple, the ledge liaison, Scott Ogan, who's been doing great work on access issues, and Brent Goodrum, our director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, also been working on the access issues.
Now, thank you. I'd encourage all of you to not use acronyms. Most of us don't speak an acronym well, and it can confuse things. I talked briefly with Commissioner of DNR, and I'm hoping that they can give us a little history of the Alaska lands issues, the present situation, and the scope of the problem, and finally the work that is going on. And it looks like this presentation here follows that outline. Of course, you can do what you want. Most of us know this stuff about how large land is and how, you know, that sort of thing, and you might go over that lightly. With that, we'll start in any order you want. Unless you object, I think we'll entertain questions as they come up, if that works for you. Also, I've got a note that Senator Stedman is overheaded on Alaska Airlines and won't be able to attend today. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to I'll lead here, but this is really, as you know, quite a team effort between all the different agencies. What we're going to try and do today here is mention is a bit of the agenda, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify on these issues. Obviously very important. Governor highlighted these in the State of the State. I will say that having watched a lot of these issues, both as a former Attorney General and in the DNR position, that it certainly is an issue that should be a concern of all Alaskans, because I think the last 4 years has been an unprecedented example of trying to lock up resources here. Certain agencies, not all, on the federal government, and as we'll get, what we want to cover is a little bit of the background, but also kind of explore a couple misperceptions that I think are out there, that the state only sues the feds. I think that's not correct at all. You'll see that. I think that there's our efforts have not been successful, which is also incorrect. And this is very important. I think Attorney General Garrity is going to talk to this as well. As this is not just Alaska. This is an issue that we're seeing all over the country, bipartisan. One of the states we're working with closely on coal issues is West Virginia, which is led by mostly Democrats. So that's just an overview. And again, we appreciate the opportunity. I will go through this slide packet quickly. You've seen this slide before, but the only reason that we mentioned this is just the federal, state, and Native corporation land issues are so important with regard to how we interact with the federal government. And I think, in my experience, it depends on where you are, but the issues of federalism, particularly as a former attorney general, and I'm sure Mike has seen this a lot, certain states feel these issues a lot, but it's usually states with a lot of federal state land mix. And, if you're Connecticut, you might not feel these federalism issues as much as you do if you're Utah or Alaska or New Mexico. And I think, as this committee knows, the issues of federalism in Alaska are very significant, and I think in part it has to do mostly with this slide. Also that we're a young state, and the relationship between the federal government, therefore, is kind of newer. And that so much of our future and economic opportunity are closely tied to this slide, to the development of our resources and how that interacts with federal authority, federal lands. How it interacts with federal authority and federal lands, and you could, this is certainly where Mike's more of an expert, but as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, there's a number of acts, federal statutes. This is not an exhaustive list, but this is a fairly important list of the statutory federal mandate that defines a lot of the relationship with regard to the state, federal government, and Native corporations on how we interact and how we can use these lands and how and to what degree the federal government can continue to have authority over these. And ILCA is one. The OCS Lands Act, a lot of people forget that the overriding kind of statutory goal by Congress in there was to develop those lands as expeditiously as possible. So these are important reference points, and obviously they're something that we focus on quite a lot. So to get more specific, I think that we've seen what we see kind of three troubling trends with regard to federal decision-making, particularly as it relates to Alaska. And a lot of these are kind of, they kind of interact. You see, I won't go through each and every one of these examples, but you see the issue of the first one, which we just see as significant overreach on some key issues supporting, involving the state. And again, these are examples. It's not an exhaustive list. Obviously, the health care legislation is not on that list, although we thought that was another example. Second, and it relates to this, is lengthy delays in permitting. That relates to federal permitting. You see examples. CD5 is one of the more notorious examples. But also on state land, too. And the Point Thompson example was one. We've established a really good relationship now with the head of the Corps here in the state. But know, that was delayed by a year and a half, and that cost the state, right? That cost the state money because we had gotten an agreement with the operators to have that development online by the winter of 2014 and 2015, and due to the delays in federal permitting and the lost winter season, we had to push that back by a year. So that's an example of direct revenues that would be lost. And as you know, delays can kill development. I think in some circles that's a strategy. And so that's another concern. And then probably from our perspective, it relates to a lot of these. The most, in some ways, the most troubling is this third one, the lack of state consultation and input. So one of the things that we've emphasized time and again with the federal officials is, look, we're not just another stakeholder. When you look at your big group of stakeholders, we're the stakeholder that has rights defined by the U.S. Constitution. So we are first among equals in our view. And the consultation aspects of decisions affecting the state are really important. And the other reason it's so important is that we have the experts on so many of these issues. Polar bear critical habitat designation is one. We have experts that are the top experts, scientists, biologists in the world. And not reaching out to us or having us have a lot of input. And Mike can talk, Attorney General Gary can talk more about the recent decision, but I think one of the reasons the court struck down the critical habitat was the lack of consultation with the state. So this is an issue that surprisingly still is a problem. We've raised it a number of times. I'll give you one example. I was having a meeting with a senior DOE, Department of Interior official, and there was talking about, hey, we need consultation. This was after the critical habitat designation, which we didn't have no input on. We were totally taken by surprise by that decision, how large it was. And we said, this is really important to us. We have the experts. We're not just another stakeholder. And committed to working harder on that. Within 12 hours of that meeting, they announced this wildlands initiative in the state. No clue. We had zero notice. So I called this guy and said, geez, we just talked about this. What's up? Well, I couldn't tell you that, and it was, you know. So this has been a huge frustration for the state. It continues to be, and but as I mentioned, a lot of those are kind of interrelated. So as I mentioned, the governor laid this out as an issue in the state of a state. But I do think it's important to give this committee a sense of where and how we've been trying to address this. And you see it's a whole number of actions that the state has been taking, monitoring activities, and I'll give you a few examples of that, advocating publicly, testimony, op-eds. The third one, in some ways, is probably the most important, building alliances with others, whether it's other entities in the state or other states, assuming authority in regulatory areas where we can, which we're allowed to legally, and you'll see the latest example that Governor announced with regard to primacy. And then this last one, I think, the second last one, I think it often gets overlooked, which is working cooperatively. We are constantly at all different levels throughout the federal government, working with them. That's the preferred method to get them as partners, and in some ways that's been helpful. Some agencies it's really helpful, others it hasn't been. And then of course the issue of litigation is also another action that we've been taking, but even that has nuances that we'll talk about briefly. So just a few examples. I think one of the things that we got a couple handouts, but there's a number of examples on kind of monitoring. This one in particular, we thought, at least for now, has been successful. A couple years ago, there was a big push right at the end of 2010 to have the president designate unilaterally by executive order ANWR as a national monument. So we heard about that. We were monitoring that. There was 40 senators in the U.S. Senate who wrote the president saying, you should do this. And we were hearing rumors that they were going to do that. So the governor wrote the President of the United States. He attached a memo from the Department of Law essentially saying, we heard you thinking about this. We think this will probably be illegal if you do this. So here's the lawsuit you're likely going to have on your lap if you take this action. So you never know why actions are not taken or taken, but we think that that was an example of monitoring where, at the end of the day, they didn't do that. And we think that was a positive outcome for the state. Certainly, unilateral designation of Anwar as a national monument would not have been something we think is in the state's interest. The next one, in this, there's a quite a lot of examples, just congressional testimony, working with state agencies, writing op-eds, particularly with regard to issues here that we think have national implications on energy development. I think most Americans, regardless of party, recognize that developing our own resources is better than importing them from Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or places like that because of the jobs, because of the foreign policy implications, national security, trade deficit. So we've been doing a lot of work on that. These are just a few examples, whether it's on Anwar. They're harder to read. There's a after the initial CD5 decision to delay that, the governor wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And we think that kind of national advocacy that we list here, a number of the testimonies that we've given before Congress on a lot of these issues, and then even articles. We worked very hard for several weeks on an article that was became a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal on the TAP's throughput decline and the federal delays, and it was front page, very long. We worked on it with the journal for quite a number of weeks, and a week or so after that, the president announced his task force to coordinate Alaska energy issues, and not sure that the Wall Street Journal article helped spur that, but maybe it did, maybe it didn't. So that kind of advocacy is important, particularly on the national stage, and we'll continue to do that. A third area that we think is very important, and again, these are just a few examples, is building alliances. So here's a few examples. The state of Washington and Oregon petitioned NOAA to delist the Stellar Sea Lion from the Endangered Species Act. The governor's, right now he's the chair, but he's been very active in what's called the OCS Governors Coalition, which is Outer Continental Shelf, to kind of advocate, work in Washington to advocate for OCS development. One that's really important that I wanted to highlight, and even today we're working on an issue that relates to this, is we've really worked hard over the last year to partner with the North Slope Borough with regard to coordinating our permitting actions, exchanging information. We signed an MOU together to work and then to advocate together. So, for example, the mayor of the North Slope Borough and I wrote the Corps of Engineers when there was the latest Point Thompson permitting delay at the end of last summer, which we were really concerned about. We wrote a joint letter, and as I'll get to here in a minute, we're working on a joint letter to the Department of Interior right now. It's likely going to be delivered tomorrow on our concerns on the Shell expedited review, but I'll talk about that in a minute. And then another example on coal issues, right? The Office of Surface Mining has really aggressively looked at, in some ways, I mean, they've done it in Alaska, but in some areas in West Virginia in particular, they've revoked previous permits, and so we've been coordinating with states with regard to OSM's actions. And so there's a lot of opportunities for alliances because these are issues that affect Alaska, but certainly not just Alaska. You'll see here this next one that we mentioned is assuming permitting authority. We've done that in terms of water waste discharge permitting. That was an issue that, again, was challenged, and we did have that was an example where we did have help from the federal government. It was challenged by certain groups that didn't want us to have that authority. Legally, you're allowed to get that authority if you go through the regulatory hoops to get that authority from the federal government, and we have that. You see a quote from Larry Hardig there. And then, as you've seen in this legislative session, the governor is looking towards that primacy issue, which will take some time with regard to dredging, filling operations that the Corps now has a responsibility for. So that's another primacy area in the wetlands area, and we think that that'll be another important development. So, but I do want to mention this area cooperation. These are just a tiny example, a number of examples of trips to Washington. You know, we have the governor's team in D.C. that does this daily. But it really is something that we're working on all the time, because this is the preference to get federal agencies to work with us, to understand our issues, and to have a cooperative spirit. I think sometimes that gets missed in the messaging. We think it's important. We're going to continue to work that, and we just hope it gets reciprocated, particularly, as I mentioned, on these issues of input and using the expertise of the state on big issues that affect Alaska. That, as I mentioned, has been a big frustration over the last 4 years, and we hope that the that there's going to be a change in that. So then the next thing, just real quickly, and this is a list that we won't kind of make that's exhaustive, but with regard to litigation, again, there's this notion that all we, when we do go to that, use that tool, which we have used, that it's kind of a reflexive, we do it automatically, and it's always against the feds. It's actually a lot more nuanced than that. You'll see this is not exhaustive at all. But this is an example of the state intervening in federal litigation where we are intervening on behalf of the federal agency that was making a decision. So, as you know, on Outer Continental Shelf leases, certain environmental groups have sued to shut down decisions that the federal government has made with regard to developing the OCS. And when they've done that, we oftentimes have looked at, well, wait, is this a decision by the federal government that we think is in the state's interest? If it is, and some of these are, certainly, the ones we see on this list, then we have intervened on behalf of the feds to support the federal decision. Now, these always don't get the press play because it's not, you know, the pounding that the, you know, I think the press kind of likes that, hey, we're taking them on. But this is a lot of what we've been working on. And I can tell you just personally, again, during my time as Attorney General, I had the opportunity with some of the Western AGs to meet with Secretary Salazar. He mentioned these. Hey, we appreciate you guys kind of defending some of the decisions we're making. He also said on ESA stuff, because it, you know, we're getting flooded with ESA litigation. He said,
define that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Endangered Species Act litigation. He even mentioned, hey, in some ways, if I were you guys, I don't blame you for the way you're kind of reacting to protect the state on those kind of issues. And then he even met with the top Department of Justice environmental lawyers and had the same reaction. Hey, thanks for the support on some of these. And then they also said, and when you guys do take us on, we always are respectful because they're usually quite thorough lawsuits. That was from the DOJ top environmental team. Department, so that's one. That's one aspect of what we've done with the feds. And I will say, even though it's not related to federal overreach, in a lot of other areas, Department of Energy, Department of State, right? We've briefed Senator Geisel's committee on, you know, the outreach that we've done in Asia. You know, the State Department in Tokyo, State Department in China. These guys have fully supported the governor's trips, my trips, to help get the word out on. So it's not a monolith, and I think that's an important message to leave. Some of the our relationship with the Department of Energy is really strong. A lot of areas of cooperation. It's been certain agencies, EPA, I think, is kind of poster child number one with problems, and some of the other Department of Interior agencies. But then there's also examples where we have had problems with federal decisions, and after consultations and after trying to convince them otherwise, we have instituted litigation. This again is just an example, and it's not an exhaustive list, But again, the point here is to show what we try to do with regard to taking action in the courts is to figure out where the state's interests lie and then move forward that way. And it's not always, sometimes it's supporting the feds, sometimes it's challenging the feds. And then the final thing I just wanted to touch on is, you know, defining success. I think there's some folks who have said, oh, these are great, these are political, they don't have any effect, right? Your actions are not, they're being lost on. And we just thoroughly reject that. And this is, first of all, it matters how you define success. And I know that that might sound a little lawyerish, but what we have seen is that this is a list of areas where we think that we've gotten to the point that has moved forward with regard to what's in the state's interest. Some of these are just court victories, right? The second one there, Governor highlighted, Attorney General Gary's team's done a great job with, you know, that court victory last week in the federal court on the critical habitat. If you read that, that's a big victory. The governor highlighted that in the state of the state. Some of these are just frustrations that we've finally gotten through, the delays in CD5 permitting, gotten that turned around. The state did a lot to go in front, back to the core with new studies saying this is why your initial decision was wrong. That was, by the way, a decision that the EPA and Fish and Wildlife Service were the ones who kind of put the veto on that bridge permitting into that. Kensington Mine, obviously, that was a huge victory in the U.S. Supreme Court, giant. Timber sales, right? We won, again, a bunch of outside environmental groups trying to shut down timber sales. That was supporting the federal government's decision to allow that. But as I mentioned, there's a number where, you know, it's not 100% clear, but we think our actions have had impact. So, as I mentioned, the executive branch, the president did not do what those 40 senators wanted, which was to designate ANWR a monument unilaterally through executive order. I think our letters and advocacy on that helped. Wildlands, that was a huge initiative of the Obama administration. Uproar, not only in Alaska but other states. A lot of potential litigation there, and I think that initiative has kind of just slowly gone away, and that was because of so many states being upset by that. And then I'll just give you one other example where I thought it was a classic case of federal overreach. You know, 2 years ago around this time we had when the taps shut down because of the leak on the North Slope, and it was getting to be a rather dicey situation because it was very cold on the North Slope to get that restarted. And this was right after Macondo, and there was a word that even though DOT and PHMSA were the federal regulatory in charge of overseeing taps, that the EPA was going to come up to Fairbanks when we were getting ready to make the decision to restart taps and kind of say, I'm in charge, we're taking over, we're going to make this decision. And so a number of us went up there, and the EPA did do that. They said they're in charge. We're, you know, going to decide on when, and it was a very urgent situation to get that. And we coordinated with Alyeska, and we essentially said, we don't recognize your authority here. We got to get this thing up and running. And we had a long day with them, and, you know, certain recommendations like before you start it, you have to have a person at every river crossing before you start that. That was one of the things they wanted us to do, which probably would have been 800 people in 40 degrees. So these are kind of things that we've just pushed back on right then, and we did get that up and running. Now, is that a success? Are all these successes? I think they are. The other one I'll mention is a lot of people say, oh, you're the Arctic moratorium. Secretary Salazar, after the Macondo disaster in the Gulf, when they put the Gulf moratorium, he slapped an Arctic moratorium on our drilling, right? Again, we had no knowledge that they were getting ready to do that. And he said there was an Arctic moratorium in testimony and in a press conference. We talked to the companies up there. All the federal agencies were told, we're not giving out any more permits. It's frozen. So we sued them. and they backed off because had there been a moratorium, a true moratorium, they probably would have violated a couple federal laws. We had a strong lawsuit. They said, no, 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 there's no moratorium after the lawsuit. They started issuing permits again. We did lose another season, by the way, of drilling that summer. And come November, October, summary judgment, the feds all came in and said, nope, there's no moratorium. The secretary says there's no moratorium. Agencies are now giving out permits, and the case was dismissed on summary judgment. So some people said, gosh, state lost. My view is, no, we won. So it depends on how you define success. And I think that on these, there's a number where we've been successful. But the details of the success sometimes aren't always known. And then finally, just we think that there are a number of unresolved issues. One that's not on this list is the EPA preemption issue with regard to the Pebble, the 404C. And, you know, Pebble mine has not come to the state yet with a permit application. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. We know that in, you know, a number of circles, that's a controversial development. That's they have to meet very high standards from the federal government once they go through permitting in the state of Alaska. But whether you support that kind of development or are very against it, having the EPA preemptively say, sorry, this whole swath of state land can't be used for, in some ways, what it was picked up from the federal government and with regard to state selections to be used for, we don't think that's in the interest of the state at all. And the AG has done a great job on advocating for that. But there's a number where, as I mentioned, ongoing concerns here. We're going to show you a letter that the governor sent to Secretary Salazar. You can see on that first bullet, but the governor is requesting that the state be part of this 60-day expedited review that the Department of Interior is doing on the shell drilling season. And, you know, there's something that we're a little worried about with regard to this review. We have we've seen this movie before, and this is exactly 2 years ago when the Macondo blowout happened in the Gulf. You had a lot of consultations. There was a lot, we clearly knew there was a lot of pressure being put on the federal government by certain groups to have a moratorium in the Gulf, but also, unfortunately, we found out later, to put a moratorium on the Arctic. We weren't consulted at all on that. They did put a moratorium on the Arctic. And now you're starting to see with this latest certain, you know, there was an op-ed by Carol Browner, some prominent former Obama administration officials saying, hey, after this Kulik thing, we should just give up on this. And we want to be part of that process. So the governor's asked Secretary Salazar in a letter that went out a couple days ago. Mayor Brower from the North Slope Borough is going to be, we're working on a joint letter from me and her to give to the deputy secretary. The borough wants to be part of this with the state, and we think that's appropriate. So these are all different areas that, you know, are ongoing areas of concern, and we think that we're going to continue to monitor these. And I know that on Thursday, this committee is going to go into a lot more detail on the navigability issues and what the state's been doing on those. And part of our team that's been working that is here. So that's just a broad overview, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Attorney General Garrity.
Just a moment, please. Any questions in the committee?
One question.
Sure. Senator Cargill.
Thank you, and I appreciate the broad overview. Just for my thinking, most of the stuff that we get to deal with on the federal government comes through the Region 10. Have we worked well with the Region 10? Do we have to go over them to the secretary level? I see where you've gone to D.C. a lot. Help me, or at least the public, understand what has to happen before you go there, or do you go to the Region 10 folks?
So through the chair, Senator Coghill, I mean, that's another area where we've tried to work the relationship really hard. So the EPA head for Region 10, Dennis McLaren, is someone that Larry Hardick works with very closely. I work with closely. I think one of the things that we've seen, and this is, it's a bit of a generalization, but, you know, I think that the agencies that are on the ground in Alaska are closer to the state, whether it's, you know, Region 10, I think it's based in Seattle. You know, a lot of times they have a pretty good understanding what's going on. They can be, we think, you know, pretty reasonable. The problem comes when you get the sense that things are being dictated from Washington. And it's, you know, it's never easy to tell how that decision-making process is taking place. But that is an example when we talk about one of the tools of cooperation with those guys. We do work very closely. I know Larry Hardick in particular has got a really good relationship with them. And it's just hard to tell when... So, for example, like the CD5 decisions, right? It's really hard to tell where those came from, but you know, we had a good sense that wasn't a, and it's more intuitive than kind of facts, but that probably wasn't a Region 10 decision. That was a decision that came from Washington.
I just wanted people to hear that is one of the steps that has to go through that. But many of these issues, from executive orders to secretary movements, get kind of pushed through Region 10, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think they have to implement some, but I'm not always sure that they're the ones advocating for some of these more broad overreach issues that we've had concern about. Hard to tell. It's hard to tell, though.
Any further questions, committee? Commissioner, back on... page 6, this is the kind of the history of the hassles, top of the page. Would you briefly explain each of these issues and what happened and why it's a problem for us?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. You mean on the significant overreach?
Negative. Top of page 6, the laws governing federal and state relations. The Alaska Statehood Act is the first one, and then it goes to ANILCA, ANSCA, and so on.
Sure. And if you want to jump in, you'd be glad. These are the different statutes, and again, it's not exhaustive, that define the relationship, particularly as it relates to... Well, statehood is broader, but a lot of these relate to land and the use of land and how much land is going to be controlled by the federal government. How much land, obviously, with ANCSA is controlled by Native corporations. And what the statutory mandates of these federal acts are. So it's really important to go into each one. They all have different areas, but I'll give you, there's the no more clauses in ANILCA, right, where that was a big compromise with regard to what lands in the state would become federal wilderness areas, a whole kind of slew of different federal designations within the state. As you probably know, Mr. Chairman, within DNR, there's a we have an office that all they do is ANILCA-related stuff because this is such an important issue for the state. But one of the things that we have concerns about, if particularly on these kind of issues, if there's federal action that's more from an executive or administrative order standpoint that we think has the potential to conflict with statutes.
Okay.
Usually in the area of the law, having an executive order trump a statute is kind of doesn't work that way.
Okay. I must not be being clear. I want you to say something like statehood act. We were supposed to get X amount of land. significant portion has not been conveyed, you know, and what does problems that cause us? What lands we're supposed to get we didn't? Anilka, a whole bunch of land was designated, you know, in essence, parks and wilderness. The Native Land Claim Settlement Act took a whole bunch of land and put it under the jurisdiction of Native corporations. You know, just give us a brief history of those things.
Well, one of the things that what we can do is we can provide a lot more detail. We have a whole team that does that with regard to the where we are on the land entitlements from the federal government to the state and the land entitlements from the federal government to Native corporations. As you're pointing out, not all of that is completed. So that's 7 million more acres or
about 5.
Yeah. About 5 million more acres with regard to entitlements from the federal government to the state. Now, as we get down to that, those smaller numbers, to be honest, the designation and entitlement issues become more complicated because the lands in some ways are something that we're looking at, regional corporations are looking at. So to go to your question, we haven't received all the lands, but again, within DNR, that's an area where there's a lot of people working. And I'm not going to say that's a issue where the feds are holding back. I do think a lot of that is just the complications of the final transfer of the lands. As I mentioned, Anilka, again, we can provide a much more detailed briefing on what that act did. And also, importantly, from our perspective, what it kind of stated was the balance with regard to where we are in terms of federal lands, the use of those lands. And as I mentioned, the no more clauses, that's what they're called, in terms of additional lands that would be under federal jurisdiction. And that's one of the issues that, to be honest, on the federal, on the NPRA issue that recently came up with regard to the federal government's designation of taking some of those lands really off the table with regard to resource development, we think that that has potential implications for some of these statutes where through an executive order these lands are being removed, and it seems to us that that might not be consistent with
okay.
the statute.
All right. Once again, you have not answered my question. I'm going to give up on it. I wanted kind of the 30,000 foot level of each of those. We'll go on. Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to dodge. Maybe I can give it to someone who's more knowledgeable.
No. I was very clear on what I wanted. It wasn't the knowledge and so on. But please get us the information in another form.
Let me, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, let me just briefly address, if I may, people who are interested in this issue have to read the compact case, what we call the compact case, which is a 25-page opinion issued by the Federal Court of Claims, 1996. It was affirmed by the D.C. Circuit without changing a word. They adopted it verbatim. Many of the popular, I'll call them arguments and theories that I hear bandied about Alaska's abilities to select its land and so on, those were addressed in the compact case. For example, there is an exception in the Statehood Act that allows the federal government to settle Aboriginal land claims. So people talk that we haven't got our selection and we've been there's an exception in the Statehood Act that allowed the federal government to do exactly what it did. So I'd be happy to provide a copy of the decision to the members of the committee and even a summary, because I know your time is valuable. But if you're interested in this issue, I think it's critical that you read that case, because many of the theories and the arguments that we hear talked about and distributed, disseminated, and so on, have been addressed and really put to rest, in my opinion. So I'll just offer that. I'd be happy to assist the commissioner, but it is, fairness to him, it's a difficult question to answer here, you know, in a few short words. But I do want to add that, because I think that's it's important to know that, at least with respect to ANSCA and how that deals with the Statehood Act. And again, I'd be happy to provide a copy of the opinion, but it's very important, I think, if people are interested in this issue. But let me, if I may, turn my attention. Let me just back up. I'll do this from 30,000 feet, Mr. Chairman, which is that, you know, we're a republic of 50 states. Sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle. And each one of these, our states, is a sovereign. So is the federal government. They are a sovereign. And so there's a constitutional doctrine called federalism, which recognizes that those two sovereigns need to coexist, and they have specific responsibilities. The federal government has enumerated powers under our Constitution. The balance of powers were reserved to the states. And so what we're talking about, to a great extent, is problems and frictions and so on that stem from that basic framework, and where we feel and other states feel that we've gotten away from the balance. The Affordable Care Act litigation that you are all familiar with, Alaska was a lead state in that. The Congress, you'll recall, one of the key features was the ability to penalize people who did not purchase insurance to participate in this, which is a key feature of this the affordable health care scheme, if you will. And the Supreme Court said that that was an impermissible exercise of the federal government's commerce power, which is how it was sought to be defended. One of the main reasons, if you look at the oral argument, was because there was no limiting principle. The justices kept asking the Solicitor General, what is the limiting principle? If we accept this exercise under the so-called Commerce Clause, what limits it? And really, there was no satisfactory answer to that. Now, it was upheld under the court's taxing, under Congress's taxing power and the federal government's taxing authority. So I'm not a constitutional scholar. I don't want to go into all that. But let me just say that there are limitations, and that they are invoked from time to time. And a lot of what we do as a state is directed to trying to redress what we think is this imbalance. And I want to really emphasize a point that the commissioner made. This is not an Alaska issue. This is not even a Republican issue. This is a bipartisan issue. I just attended a summit last week in Oklahoma City, convened by the Oklahoma Attorney General, on federalism and fossil fuels. And there were several panels of people from industry and from the academia, from law and so on. And there was probably over 40 states that are represented, and 7 or 8 attorney generals, including myself. And this is an issue that resonates throughout the country. There's just, let me just give you a brief example of cases, and this is not exhaustive by any means, but Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona. Arizona is challenging in the Supreme Court the federal government's position that the Voter Registration Act preempts Arizona's law, voter ID law. Now, we can all debate the wisdom of whether voter ID laws are good or bad, and I don't mean to take that up. But, again, voting is typically a matter that's been reserved for the states. That's going to be argued this term before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not lands issue specifically, but it is a state-federal issue, and that's not the only case Arizona's doing. There also Arizona got an immigration. It's not an issue that resonates up here much, but Arizona and the states in the Southwest, that's a big issue. And that's almost an example of federal underreach, where the states feel the federal government's not doing enough to enforce its responsibility to enforce the immigration laws and so on. And so Arizona's state passes its own statute aimed at trying to enforce immigration laws and so on, and it got into a big battle with the federal government. And the Supreme Court later said that four of the main features of the state act were preempted by the federal government, but Arizona was allowed to proceed with one enforcement link in the law that they passed at the state. Montana Shooting Sports Association versus Holder. Montana intervened in a case challenging Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause to regulate the intra state manufacture and sale of firearms. That's going to be argued before the Ninth Circuit in March. We joined an amicus brief in that case. That was a Democratic attorney general in Montana who brought that case. Farrell Cooper Mining Company versus Office of Surface Mining and Reclamation Enforcement. Oklahoma is challenging in the Tenth Circuit the Federal Office of Surface Mining and Reclamation Enforcement's use of authority under the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. And the commissioner mentioned, okay, we have a very similar case to this involving Wishbone Hill, very similar. Under this act, the federal office may notify state regulatory authority when the office has reason to believe that a person is in violation of any requirement of the act or a permit condition required by the act. If the state authority fails to take appropriate action within 10 days of the notice, the office may order a federal inspection of the mining operation involved. And if that inspection reveals risk of harm, the office may order the operation to cease. Oklahoma alleges that the office, the federal office, is using this 10-day notice authority to challenge the validity of permits issued under the state program, which the federal office approved. We've joined that amicus brief as well. Again, we have a very similar issue here in Alaska involving Wishbone Hill. So those are just a small sample of cases, but I just want to assure this committee that it's a mischaracterization to claim that our governor is just interested in suing the federal government and that that's a big part of the agenda. That's not the case. These are bipartisan issues across party lines and are going on across this country. And you know, I'm a member of the National Association of Attorney Generals, as my predecessor was. And so we're all the time getting, we see these issues, and we're being asked to join amicus briefs and intervene in cases and so on. So it's something that I'm sure we see more often and why I'm more sensitive to. But I can just assure this committee that this is not an Alaska issue by any means. The wrinkle in Alaska is the lands issue. And the wrinkle is we've got some statutes, which the chairman pointed out on page 5, are really specific to Alaska. It's difficult sometimes for us to enlist other states because, you know, we have ANILCA. That's just Alaska. We have ANSCA, the Alaska Native Settlement Claims Act. That's just specific to Alaska. So while, you know, we have sympathy in these cases, they're very unique to our state, and so we do solicit support, and we have obtained support before. And you know, another case that I'm sure they're familiar with now is the Sackett versus EPA. That was a case in which we led the effort to get 9 other states on that brief, challenging the EPA's authority to force this couple to, you know, get a wetlands permit for their home in Idaho, or else face fines of $75,000 a day or some ridiculous thing. So that was, again, there are common interests here. I don't join every case I'm asked to join because I think the interest is too remote to Alaska, and I'll be honest with you. But everyone's evaluated and analyzed carefully on its own merits. And so but we do have cases with the federal government, and I do want to cover those briefly because they are important. The Endangered Species Act, or ESA litigation, we're involved in a number of fronts. The game changer has been climate change. That's what's really, in the last few years, has changed. And it's primarily, right now, it's largely an Alaska issue. I mean, I don't think any states have bearded and ringed seals, for example. No other states have polar bears. So we're confronting it, but I think we're the tip of the iceberg, and I believe we're going to see climate change affect other states as well and species in those states. But the polar bear listing is based on a 50-year model. 50 years out, polar bear populations right now are healthy. That is not seriously disputed by any scientist. But 50 years out, based upon the climate change, and this modeling, this predictive modeling that they're trying to do, and along with the modeling, they try to predict what the habitat's going to look like in 50 years. That is what the in this case, the NMFS, or National Marine Fisheries Service, is basing its analysis on. We challenge that. The models and our state scientists submitted comments, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service nonetheless concluded that polar bear qualified as a threatened species. What that means is it's likely to be on the brink of extinction throughout all of its range in the foreseeable future. And again, that's 50 years out. In our opinion, this violated the Endangered Species Act. We did challenge that. District Court ruled against us. It's on appeal to the D.C. Circuit. It was argued in October, and we're awaiting a decision. But another one that just happened is the bearded and ringed seals. Now, there's millions, literally millions of these seal species throughout, and not just in Alaska, but Canada and so on, other Arctic regions. But that's based on a 100-year model, 100 years out, based upon that what they predict is the loss of sea ice and so on and so forth, and what the habitat will do. That, again, it's but it's still a foreseeable future standard, but that's how far out they are now pushing it. So we are alarmed by this modeling, and it's something that we're working closely with Fish and Game here in Alaska to hire experts to do our own modeling, start doing our own testing and sampling. I mean, it's something that I'm a lawyer, but I'm a lay person like you when it comes to the Endangered Species Act. And, you know, I always thought the speculation was speculation, and speculation by a scientist is still speculation in my book. But unfortunately, the courts are required by statutes, decisions, authority primarily, that, you know, they give deference to. They're not scientists, and so they give deference to the government scientists. And nonetheless, we are challenging these deals, I just feel it's you know, do you win or do you lose? I mean, that's not how I keep score. I mean, to me, we have a responsibility. I have a responsibility to challenge these. We cannot sit on the sidelines and let these decisions go unchallenged. Because once the species is listed, the next step is determining critical habitat. And when the federal government makes a decision on what is the critical habitat for the threatened species, that essentially federalizes our state land. And so any activities that take place on our state lands that are permitted by the state have to go through an analysis to determine what's the impact and harm and so on to the species. Greatly complicates your environmental impact statements and so on and so forth, but it could, depending on what it is, it could stop the development on our state lands. As the commissioner mentioned, and as I know this committee is aware, we, in terms of the critical habitat for the polar bear, that the district court here in Anchorage did agree with the state that the critical habitat designation was overbroad, and it was vacated in its entirety. As a result, natural resource projects and municipal developments like roads, infrastructure, ports, bridges, and airport improvements, and oil and gas exploration development in the North Slope and related areas that may require federal permits or approvals because of this designation can now proceed without having to address impacts to excessive polar bear critical habitat. It was almost 190,000 square miles, is what they designated. As critical habitat. It is areas where polar bear have never been. And the district court, in its decision, among other things, said in its current form, the critical habitat designation presents a disconnect between the twin goals of protecting the cherished resource and allowing for growth and much needed economic development. The current designation went too far and was too extensive, and it's been vacated. I'm sure it's going to be appealed, and then we'll have another battle before the Ninth Circuit, which is not always friendly to us. But again, I'm not going to I don't keep score. I mean, we want to win them all, and we give it our best shot, but we have a responsibility, it seems to me, to fight these fights and to give it our best. Another one, Stellar Sea Lions. This is costing jobs. I mean, the Stellar Sea Lion designation and the other measures taken by National Marine Fisheries Service to protect the species has caused. Judges shut down the pollock fishery down in the Aleutians, and it's been noted and recognized in the record. There's two what they call distinct population segments, or DPS. There's an eastern DPS, which, as the commissioner mentioned, that was recently delisted. So that population is very healthy. The western DPS is the one that they're still trying to protect. It's actually been listed as endangered for some years, but NIFS, again, if I may use that, Mr. Chairman, the National Marine Fisheries Service, is required to engage in consultations to determine if there's less, if there's mitigation measures, as we say, to what they call reasonably prudent alternatives to allow the species to recover, you know, without engaging in shorter steps, short of the critical habitat designation and steps that still allow economic development so on to continue. And those mitigation measures were closing off some areas to fishing. In 2006, a new consultation was initiated to determine how fisheries were affecting the sea lions. In our view, and the data showed that the western DPS had stabilized and actually increased in some of the areas that they were looking at. But there was one area in particular that had not increased, it had decreased. So NIMS found that the fisheries were jeopardizing the sea lions, issued a new biop or biological opinion with more severe prudent alternatives, which essentially shut down the fisheries on an even broader scale. And as I said, jobs, it's cost jobs, no question about that. The state, with industry, challenged that biop, and the district court rejected that challenge, but we appealed it to the Ninth Circuit. That was argued last month. I heard went about as well as could be expected. Before the Ninth Circuit argument, but after the briefs had filed, the NIMS had actually commissioned an independent panel to review the science. I read the district court opinion last year when I took this job, and I was struck by how thin the science was and how, again, speculative the whole basis for assuming that fisheries were harming the pollock species and causing this nutritional stress, as they call it, in the sea lions. But again, the courts give deference to the feds on this. But NIMS, I think, in response to some of the concerns, commissioned an independent panel to look at it, and they issued an opinion which found that the science was flawed, that the stellar sea lion, the whole basis for predicting that fisheries were affecting the pollock and so on, and that it was nutritional stress that was causing the decline in population and so on, was flawed, and it was not sound. And that independent panel issued its results after the briefing had been completed, but we did get that in the record, and I talked to the attorney who was at the oral argument, and the Ninth Circuit panel, had read, you know, and was aware of this independent panel, what they'd found. So, again, I'm not here to predict results, but I'm very hopeful that we can get a decision, because that's one where it is costing jobs and it's having a real impact. Another question, to get away from endangered species for a minute, we have brought a lawsuit against the feds, the EPA, over the Emission Control Area, or ECA. That's this ribbon of 200-mile extent of ocean from the shoreline, running from the coast of Mexico up the west coast of Alaska and the east coast as well. It's just right around the U.S. And extends all the way through to southwestern Alaska. You know, it ends in the Aleutians, but definitely it affects the Port of Anchorage. It requires low sulfur fuel to be burned in that area. Now, you know, that's good. It reduces emissions. The case was joined recently, the South Coast Air Quality Air District from Southern California intervened in the case because they want an ECA in Southern California. And I'd like them to have an ECA in Southern California. 16 million people live in the South Coast Air Quality District. I forget the percentage, but you can imagine the vehicles, but this encompasses the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. they have serious, serious air pollution problems in Southern California, and these shipboard emissions are a major factor, and they're very interested in protecting the integrity of the ECA, and I don't blame them. But the point is, why did the EPA extend it to Southern Alaska? We have air quality up here that meets or exceeds the national air standards, at least in our coastal areas, all the time. And it's, again, this one-size-fits-all mentality that the EPA has adopted. And when they came out with their notice of proposed, you know, with soliciting comment, their actual comment was, ideally, we would like to include Alaska. Well, yeah, when I hear a federal regulatory agency say something like that, I mean, it kind of raises my hackles. And I mean, that's not how you're supposed to determine regulations and what you do. It's ideally, we'd like to. I mean, you're not supposed to, whether you like it. It's not whether there's a scientific basis. It's going to, because this will raise the cost of goods to Alaskans. I mean, we can debate about how much it is. In August 1, 2015, the low sulfur fuel requirements will be replaced by ultra low sulfur fuel requirements, which is even more expensive than the low sulfur fuel. So it's a transitional phase. So all it can do is increase the cost of goods. 90% of the goods consumed by 85% of all Alaskans come through the Port of Anchorage. And so, again, I didn't think I could sit on the sidelines and let this go into effect without mounting a challenge. A very difficult case. I'm not going to kid anybody about that. Very difficult case, very challenging. But I think we marshaled some good arguments. The motion for preliminary injunction, the briefing will be complete next month, and then we'll probably get a decision, I would think, during the second quarter. The commission mentioned the Tongass. Again, this is an area where the state and federal government used to work well together. This is an area where there was cooperation, I would say, particularly at the local level. There was, you asked the question, Senator Coghill did, about Region 10 and so on. We had a good relationship with the local people here who were administering the federal program. They used to routinely offer 400 million board feet a year annually from the Tongass, and supported two pulp mills down in the southeast. But in 1990, ANILCA was amended by the Tongass Timber Reform Act, and at that point they changed it to, so the 400 million board feet, it said that they would, the feds would seek to meet annual demand for timber, but it was subject to conditions, including funding. And so those, as a result, timber and the Tongass is just falling off the table. I mean, and there's so much discretion at the local level. There's so much discretion in the act, I should say. I still believe there's some support at the local level for it. At least I'm told that. But it's dropped off dramatically. Of course, the pulp mills have closed. And we're challenging, among other things, there's a roadless rule that was adopted that put a severe crimp. Now, the Tongass was supposed to be exempted from the roadless rule because of ANILCA, among other things. But the Federal District Court here last year ruled that temporary rule that they had instituted to allow Tongass to be exempted from the roadless rule had expired, or it was no longer valid. And so we are now subject to the roadless rule. And it's, as I said, I think, if I mentioned the Wyoming case, but Wyoming has a case, a certiorari petition, I should say, challenging the notion of the roadless rule, obviously, in Wyoming, but that obviously would have an application for Alaska as well. But that's another area where other states, it's affected other states, and other states are doing very similar to what we're doing. We've got cases going on navigability, the Mosquito Fork River, we feel is a navigable waterway, and if it is, then it's state property, period. And we can regulate activities on state lands. Federal government takes a position that this portion of the river that we're talking about is not navigable, so we sued the federal government over that. We don't believe their analysis is sound or correct. And, again, that has to do with our ability to manage what we think are lands that were given to us in statehood. So to refer back to that. Should I need to wrap it up? Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to ramble on.
Here we are. And you know, it's a judgment call, how deep we drill down into each things and so on.
No, I appreciate that.
I apologize.
Oh, no, it's fine.
For showing my frustration. I should have been more clear before this meeting ever happened. And what I was hoping could happen was you would explain the statehood compact, why other lands weren't conveyed, what are the issues, and where are we at in that process. And then we go on to ANILCA. You know, what portion of ANILCA took lands that had been selected by the state, you know, and so on, and diminished that, and was there any swaps, and so on. And then what are the value of those lands that the feds took away from state jurisdiction, whether it might be mines, oil, timber, and so on. And it's same on with ANSA, you know, and we all know that much of the development we're able to see in more remote areas is because of the view of many of the native corporations. And what's happening with that? And what an asset. We talked yesterday about Moose Range, you know, and so on. And then what we are doing in general on each of those issues, you know, what are our chances and so on, and will we ever get to see in the State Compact Act? Right now, I'd like to give you a chance to talk about a little bit about their RS-2477 issue, you know, and where are we at on that?
Well, where we are is we're getting ready, we're on the verge of a filing to perfect our, what we believe, our legal rights away under that federal law.
And please explain what it is.
RS-2477 is, it used to be, and I'm going to defer to Mr. Sullivan, the Assistant General who's dedicated this full time, Mr. Chairman, but the used to be under the it's a very old law from the 19th century, that if you had a trail or a right-of-way, if you will, or even back in those days it just would have been a trail, over federal land that was used and was traditionally recognized and there was traditional use there and so on and so forth, that you could perfect that right, the state could, and trump the federal government if it was federal government land, which in these examples all are. And that law, I think it was in 1974, Congress changed the law, but it didn't go back and retroactively affect that. So a number of states, Utah is the primary example, as well as Alaska, we've been going back to determine where these trails and right-of-ways exist in Alaska. They're very difficult. They've got to be documented. We have to find people who have used them. We need photographic evidence if we can, because many of them are not in, many of them are in use today, but many of them are not. Their use is so infrequent that you can't really photograph and document as well as we'd like. So the ones we're focusing on are on the chicken area. They're well-recognized trails, and we have to notify their landowners. There's other miners that potentially involve the user claims. They conflict or overlap with mining claims, so we need to quiet title to those claims as well. So it's a complicated matter. I know we were waiting for title reports the last time I talked to Mr. Sullivan, but we need to get all that information together, but we're going to be filing very soon, and I don't want to put a timeline on it, but I hope Mr. Sullivan can, but very soon we'll be filing on those. And there's several hundred of them that we've identified. Mr. Ogun in Commissioner Sullivan's office has been working on this full time. I'd also defer to him, but there's several hundred that have been identified over time that we've just been able to research and locate. Now the difficult part is, again, is finding the testimonial and other evidence to support this historical and tradition use. The ones we're focusing on and going to court with first are the ones where we feel we've got the strongest case. They're still in current use and so on. But we hope to get those, file those claims and eventually get the court to recognize our interest in those and to not discredit, but to get a clarification that those are state, not federal. They're state, and they don't belong to a mining claim. They belong to the state. So that's And then we can control and regulate their use and be allowed to use them as the case may be for further development in those areas.
Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, one thing, as Attorney General's mentioning, it is a lot of work to establish the evidence. It's not just something you can kind of, hey, file this, and if you do it with a flimsy background, you're not going to get very far. So we appreciate the legislature's support, both at DNR and in the Department of Law, on providing the funding for that work. And we've been working at it pretty hard, and as Attorney General's mentioning, getting ready to take some actions. And then it's also kind of another theme throughout today's testimony. We have been working, our teams have gone down to Utah in particular to kind of learn from those guys, because they have really taken this issue on and have put a lot of effort into it, a lot of resources into it, and it's been a good opportunity for our team, both from law and DNR, to go and kind of get a sense of how they're working it and learn from them.
Yeah, and just saying, I've met with those guys in Utah, and I'm very impressed with what they're doing. They've formed a board or a commission down there to overlook that stuff. Is that a good idea, and how does that relate to CATCUS, if at all?
To CATCUS?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that acronym. If that's an acronym, or is it something else?
Okay. And may I? What is it?
Citizens Advisory Committee.
Oh, pardon me. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I'll take that first. I mean, I met with the Assistant Attorney General from Utah, who came up here and talked to her about her program and what they're doing. Utah is filing on, we'll see, 10,000. They got a much, much more ambitious program. It's a larger state. You know, trails down there, they don't have the climate conditions and so on. We have up here that tend to obliterate stuff like that over time. So it's a different situation, but they have, it's a big project for them, and they have a lot of people looking at it. I feel we, with the legislature's support, we have all the resources we need at present, and I won't speak for DNR, but I feel we've got the resources. We have met and consulted with GAFCA and got information from them and their thoughts, and we're always looking for people who have information about these trails and can talk about them. So,
all right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how many lawsuits have we filed in the last 5 years against the federal government, and what has been sort of our win-loss ratio, and how much have we spent on those lawsuits?
Well, it obviously predates my tenure as senator by quite a bit. I don't see there's an exhaustive list. I'm aware of less than 10 right now I think we have pending. We could go back and look at that, because I don't have an answer for it off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to research that and provide it in writing. But right now, currently, we have about 10, with the exception of our Endangered Species Act litigation, in which we do use outside counsel. We handle these, the ones we've currently got, we're doing them in-house. We have a lot of expertise that's been developed over time in litigating these issues and challenging them. So I'd be happy to research that, Senator. I don't have an answer right now.
Thank you.
And the win-loss record, I think, is, you know, we talked about that. The Commissioner mentioned that sometimes it's a subtle distinction, but, you know, I can provide that information as well.
All right. And we would like to, you know, the information I've talked about. Don't ever overestimate how informed we legislators are. There's a lot of issues, and I'm hoping to set the stage here for it. But don't spend a lot of time on it. Just give us the bigger overview, and then we can go back and ask questions about the specifics. I've got a guy on the phone here who has one of the very issues. Part of what we need to know is, how's this affecting individual Alaskans? And he got a permit, got a recreation mine, got a permit from the state, got a permit for stream crossings, got a permit where he could park his equipment, you know, when he can't, because he can only travel across the ice, you know, and so on and so forth. Apparently did it all, had his equipment parked where the state said he could. The feds came and seized it all. you know, and he is very pleased that the state is intervening and helping him fight that battle. But and he's been listening in. His name is Mark Stefanski, and can you hear us, Mark?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. Was my summary of your situation correct?
Yes. I would like to clarify, sir, that the equipment that was confiscated, it belongs to my brother. He was subcontracting the moving of material so that we could build a cabin out at Dan Creek, Alaska. So because I subcontracted him to do the work, it affects our ability to get our job done in the building of our place out at Dan Creek. Dan Creek is the oldest operating gold mine in the state. They discovered gold there in 1901. There have been trails, wagon trails, horse trails, traditional access methods that have been used and in place since 1901. Now the federal government has asked us to sign a right-of-way certificate to access land. I've talked with the state. The state says that that's a public access corridor. We don't understand why the federal government is asking us to sign, you know, yet another piece of paper to grant us access to the land that we have legal access to. In the process of building this place, my brother had equipment parked on state right-of-way. Folks from state officials from the Anchorage office helped us with the maps to understand the legal standing of that state right-of-way. The Park Service confiscated that equipment back in 2010 and have yet to return it. My brother's case is still in litigation with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's been thrown into the same litigation pile as John Sturgeon. John Sturgeon, as you may recall, is the moose hunter who's questioning the issues regarding submerged lands and navigable waterways. In his case, in my brother's case, his equipment was parked on the riverbed about 100 feet from the bank. The federal people said that the river's in danger of flooding and we're going to seize that equipment. I had been in contact with him over this equipment. The river never came anywhere near flood stage, and I basically have the hydrological data to show us that. But again, there's just been interference by the feds in our case. They've stopped me at the airport out in McCarthy. They wanted to know, you know, what I was doing out there, and I let them know that I had all the legal permits, and they were telling me that that things could happen to me that happened to Papa Pilgrim. And Papa Pilgrim is a character in the history out there who basically was a loner who stood up to the federal government and ended up getting arrested and jailed for his actions out there on Park Service land. My private land that I own is in the middle of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. This is why the federal people are involved. My traffic route takes me over the Nizina River, and the Nizina River is part of the submerged land that is under court action right now between the state of Alaska and the feds regarding whether or not it's a navigable waterway. So that's our public access corridor.
Mike, Mark?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thanks for your testimony. We're about out of time. When we talked on the phone the other day, you said that the state had been quite good both with the permits and helping you in this battle. Did I read you right on that?
That is correct, Senator.
Okay. So thank you for intervening on a citizen, and it's a fair illustration of some of the issues that individual Alaskans and I think we really appreciate the effort you make, not only on the global scale, but down in the nuts and bolts and trenches of this sort of thing. Are there any further questions or comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, just talking to Mr. Ogan here, I think one of the things that we're looking at in addition to what was mentioned here is the navigability of the Nizina River, which we think likely is navigable.
Yeah. All right. Well, You're on the side of the angels. Keep going, and anything that we can do to be helpful. If you think it's to be valuable, maybe we'll come back and visit on these issues again. Senator Geisel.
Well, I just wanted to also thank the Department of Law for intervening on the Sturgeon case. That gentleman is my constituent. You wrote a wonderful document supporting him, and thank you for doing that.
And that was on my list of things. I was getting to that in my own protracted way, Senator, but and the gentleman, Mr. Stefanski, mentioned the case, and so I don't want to, that was an omission just because of scheduling and time I didn't get to, but I certainly acknowledge that's an important case for us as well to support.
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Also, with regard to Senator Bulikowski's question, probably on balance, you know, if you're going to get information on the suits to the feds and the cost, it might also be interesting to know how many of the outside NGOs have taken us to court where we've had to either intervene because of federal issues and or we've had to defend ourselves with our own rules and laws. If we're going to balance that conversation, it should be how many times we've had to sue to protect our right as a state, and then how many times we've had to go to court because of non-government organizations that want to use either the federal agency or their own standing to challenge the state. So just how many times we've had to do that and the cost.
And I think, Senator, that would relate to some of the ones we had listed here. That's typically the posture of cases where we're actually supporting federal agency decisions. Not always, but a lot of times you'll have a federal agency decision, for example, the OCS lease sales that wanted to go through. They did. The agency in question allowed them to go forward. Outside environmental groups sued to stop that, and then we intervened. So, as I mentioned, there's a number of times that we're getting involved to support those decisions that we think are in the state's interest, and we'd be glad to provide that list as well.
Thank you. Any other further questions? Thank you. It's been very valuable. State affairs is adjourned.